obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Hi, I'm Diana, and I am a grateful member of Al-Anon.
Hi, Diana.
And I want to thank some people. I want to thank Kathy because she called me after I spoke at the 502 and said, hey, let's have you out to the desert. And I said, absolutely. And because of her invitation, I'm standing here this morning listening to these readings, realizing how absolutely perfect God's timing is. And I am in exactly the right place, doing exactly the right thing. And that feels pretty good because I have a very insane story, like most of us. I don't know that anybody walks into an Al-Anon meeting for the first time going, hi, I have a very sane, manageable life, and everything's great. That is certainly not why I showed up. So anyway, because I'm here, I got to be treated by Brandy with such love and care, the speaker hostess. You know our brother program AA, and there's an alcoholic ego over there that they need to keep in check. For Al-Anons, I know my experience has been really that feeling of unworthiness, just being unwanted, unloved, and alone. And to show up here and to feel such love and find hearts all over my room. And when I got out of the shower this morning and looked in the mirror naked and there's a heart right next to it, you are loved. And I'm like, good timing. Perfect. Thank you. So thank you so much. It is an honor and it is definitely a check on my recovery because every time I think I'm not I think, oh, if I'm not worthy, then nobody's worthy, because the whole point of Al-Anon is I'm worthy not because I've earned something or done something, but just because I exist. And that is definitely not my story. Like the reading, since with me it was more like kindergarten, not preschool, I have been trying to earn the right to be well and happy and joyous and free. I didn't think that that was something that I deserved, and I definitely thought that accomplishing that was my responsibility. Now remember, we're talking about a six-year-old child. So the Hope for Today reading was so awesome. Of course, I've read that book for 20 years. Well, I don't know if it's been out 20 years, but since it's been out, I've read it every morning, and I've never read that page. I don't know when they slipped that one in, but it is eerily connected to my life and my story. I do yoga now, and that's amazing because I'm just not that kind of person. I'm driven, and yoga seems to be about relaxing. But so I've been led by my higher power back to yoga, and I've been practicing since July at a studio in Claremont. And they have this thing called restorative yoga. And what we do basically is like hug a big pillow and breathe for an hour. And I show up there because I can't breathe. And I show up there because I'm out of my mind. And I show up there because I've been paralyzed in my living room for a week with my head screaming, you know, stay, and my body yelling run, and or the other way around, you know, and just finally peel myself up off the couch and drag myself to the restorative yoga class. There's two of us. We're both in various insane spaces. And so the teacher says, I'm going to just modify the class to suit you two, you know, blah, blah. I know what she's saying. Boy, you guys need help. So about 45 minutes into this hugging this pillow and breathing, she's teaching us how to breathe, which is a good thing to learn, and I never learned long in my alcoholic home growing up. My head is screaming, what the hell good is this going to do? You're just breathing, you know. But then I got in touch with this place that I hadn't been in since nap time in kindergarten. All of a sudden, I was back at Pomona Valley Christian School in 1966 on the floor on my towel, and for a minute, I was okay, you know? And I felt that feeling, and that was just this last August, and as I walked out, I said to the yogi, you know, thank you. My husband thanks you too, because a different woman is coming home than came to this class this morning. And I said, I got back to a feeling of total peace and comfort and ease that I hadn't felt since I was in kindergarten. Thank you. And she said, yeah, she said, I've got a son who's 5, and I watch him breathe, and he does this deep diaphragm breathing. And I think, you know, when do we lose that? And I said, well, for me, it was age 6. And she tilts her head, you know, oh, I wonder what happened. You know, cue Diana's Al-Anon story. I remember exactly what happened, and I remember exactly where I was, and so I'm going to just share a bit of that with you guys this morning, and I appreciate you very much listening.
There's a shelf down there
under the water. Always helpful, aren't we? I know we are. We're so helpful. We're the most helpful people on the planet. Thank God for us. And so basically, I'm 6 years old, and my family takes a vacation down to Bahia Hotel in San Diego. I'm from a very loving, very stable, very middle-class alcoholic home. My folks met at Ohio State, and mom got with child, so they faked a anniversary wedding date and got married and did what you do in the 50s, and they gave birth to my older brother and set out building a lovely home for their children and did every single thing they could do till their last breath to make that happen. There was the untreated disease of alcoholism in that marriage, however, and they didn't know that, and I didn't know that, and there had been an untreated disease of alcoholism in their childhoods as well. My father's father had died of alcoholism, and my mother's mother was certainly an alcoholic, and her father had left when she was 8 years old. This would have been 1938. She'd never heard her parents argue in that upper middle class WASP family that she was raised in, and her mom just said, "Your father and I are separating. You need to be a good little soldier." And so mom was told to swallow her feelings about never seeing her dad again, and she carried that into her adulthood and then gave birth to me. And so when I hear in recovery that, you know, people give you what they have to give and they can't give you what they don't have to give, I always think about that fact. But mom and dad both had jobs, and they bought a home, and we had dinner every night at the table, my two older brothers and I and my mom and my dad, and we sat down, and we weren't supposed to eat until the hostess picked up her fork. It was all very lovely. And my dad was an alcoholic. And so my father was obsessed with alcohol. My mother was obsessed with my father's alcoholism. Pretty simple. I didn't know that. When it was a lot of fun being a kid in my family. They were real funny, and my older brothers treated me like a little mascot. And, you know, I remember a lot of fun. And so we were down there at Bahia, and I'm six, like I say, and excited. And my older brothers are like, hey, come see this fancy car by the pool. I remember that. We get to the pool. My father has cracked his skull open. He jumped off the high dive at 6'4" and hit the bottom of the pool. And so he's there, and he's bleeding. And I remember an ambulance. My older brother doesn't, whatever. The next thing I remember is my mother grabbing my arm and yelling, "That's it, I've had it, I'm getting a divorce!" And the world as I knew it ended. You know, my sense of belonging went away. And I remember screaming, "No, mommy, don't, please, no, don't." And she yanked me, and we went down some path, and, you know, it wasn't, "How's your dad?" or "What's happened to dad?" or "Is he going to be okay?" or, you know, no, it was just, I'm at, and so that's the moment I decided that my family needed fixing, and it was up to me. And I think it's kind of a reasonable conclusion to draw. You know, the more I look back at my story, the more I realize I really had logical reactions to things. The illogic of it was thinking that I could do a thing about any of it. Choose who my mother's married to, choose whether my father's addicted to alcohol or not. Ultimately, when my brother had a nervous breakdown and was diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic, you know, I began to take that on, to choose to fix that. And, you know, not only am I the youngest and the girl, I guess that's about it, I'm the youngest and the girl and powerless over these adults, but just like the reading said this morning, that was not what my head told me was an acceptable response. Oh, this is your life, and you need to accept it. What I heard was, if you're ever going to be safe and get what you need, these two adults have to stay together, and it's going to be up to you, and you're going to get them to stay together by being perfect. So you can never again have any unacceptable feeling or commit any unacceptable behavior, and from here on out, everything that your mother sees has to make her happy. I don't know if she ever said that to me out loud, but if you grew up in an alcoholic home like mine, you know that that message is transmitted in various ways. I do remember one time after my brother had his nervous breakdown and was in and out of jails and institutions, I got home from some like church weekend or something, and my mother said, "Your brother was arrested this weekend, but I think I've been able to keep it out of the papers because I'm friends with the city editor of the Prague, you know." It's like, okay. So again, it's like we hop right over the emotional impact, right, of the chaos and the turmoil of mental illness and alcoholism, and we get right to what are other people thinking, and can we pretend Like, all of this isn't happening. And I happen to become extraordinarily good at pretending. And I think pretending saved my life until you guys saved it. Right. So I'm not here to knock pretending. If you listen to AA speakers, they don't knock alcohol because they needed it until it didn't work anymore. Well, I needed to pretend that I was perfect and that everything was okay and that I was going to be able to fix it. I've got this. Don't worry, Mom. I've got this. I made her a stuffed animal when I was like 6 years old. I made my mother a stuffed animal. It's just backwards, you know. She's supposed to be comforting me, and I'm comforting her because I sense a deep and unmet need and hallelujah, Diana's here. We're going to fix this. So following that traumatic event at the hotel in San Diego where I saw my world fall apart, I got to class, second grade, was beginning that fall a couple months later, and my mom was there after a few weeks of school. I was terrified. I was in trouble because, remember, I can't be in trouble. So I'm terrified, can't breathe. I get to the principal's office, and it turns out Mom's happy. I'm sensing this. And oh, Diana, you know, something good's happened. Would you like to be in Mrs. Phillips's class? So, like a good little unrecovered Al-Anon, I don't say, I don't know why, let me think about it. I say, yes. And I remember thinking, what's happening? What is happening to me? And we get to the door of Mrs. Phillips's class, and it opens, and there's third graders in there. And another level of trauma and terror enters my life because I am scared of second graders already. And I'm young. I was born in November, so I was always a little younger than their kids anyway. I've had this emotional trauma in the summer where I know I have to be the best and the brightest, and I'm really not because I come from some screwed-up family with public humiliation, right? I heard a speaker recently say he remembered the first time his family was, you know, humiliated in public. There's public drama, and I was like, oh, my God, I remember my first public drama, too. And so here I am standing at the door, and my guts run cold. And, of course, the logical thing to do is turn and say, oh, Mom, I misunderstood. I'm really not emotionally prepared to skip into third grade. And besides, I'm already responsible for being perfect. And so how am I supposed to be a perfect third grader when I'm already pretty sure I'm not going to be a very good second grader? Too scared to ask to go to the bathroom that first 2 weeks of second grade. Peed on the floor by the time I'm straggling up to the teacher going, can I go to the bathroom? I'm so terrified of making any kind of waves whatsoever. And if you grew up in an alcoholic home like mine, you understand. I was talking about walking on eggshells. I'm walking on eggshells. And so instead of turning to my mother and saying that, I did what we learn to do in alcoholic families where we are abandoned emotionally. I learned to abandon myself emotionally, and I abandoned myself emotionally in that moment. And I stepped into that classroom filled with terror. They had made ashtrays. It was the 60s, and it was this beautiful new modular classroom, and it had a kiln. They had an actual kiln there. This was back when the California public schools were well-funded, right? And so it was this beautiful thing. So, you know, here's my Al-Anon brain. Okay, I'm a third grader now. Third graders make ashtrays. Where's your ashtray? Okay? Not... That's okay, honey. You're coming into this several weeks into the semester, so of course you haven't done this project yet. Let's pick it up from here and move on, like I would understand today with the Al-Anon wisdom. So I stole one. Palmed it, put it down in my little backpack, and I turned it over. Tony had carved his name into it before he had, because he had done the work. Tony had done the work. So I crossed that out, and I wrote my name in pencil, Diana, and I took it home to my mom and said, look what your third grader made today, Mom, you know. And Mom, I remember, she said, oh, honey, this is beautiful. And then she flipped it over and said, why does it say Tony on it? And I said, he stole mine. Stole mine. He carved his name in it. Mom said, oh, that's terrible, honey. Well, okay. And she set it there on the shelf, and it stayed there as a trophy, a testament to my phoniness and my inadequacy for the rest of my childhood. I couldn't look at that thing without cringing with shame and yet feeling that feeling, just like the reading this morning, that's okay because the puzzle pieces are going to have to fit. The puzzle pieces are going to have to fit. I had no concept of fixing myself to the world. The world had to be fixed to me. And okay, if we've made ashtrays, we've made ashtrays. During elementary school, I remember taking a trip with Mom and Dad up to San Francisco, and I have great pleasurable memories of that afternoon. We spent it in a hotel room while I played cocktail waitress and served my father scotches. So Mom had loved San Francisco. She'd lived there during World War II as a teenager, and she had that was the happiest time of her life. So she takes her husband, alcoholic, her little kid up there, and We spend the afternoon not seeing the sights of San Francisco, but me with my little pad and paper, scotch and water, scotch and water, scotch and water. And I remember feeling so loved and so important and so seen and so necessary. And then I remember also my mother in the corner of the room just stewing. Just, I didn't come to San Francisco to sit in a hotel room while you drink. She didn't know she could have walked out that door. She just didn't know. She could have taken her daughter, and we could have gone and gotten on a cable car. We could have gone out to Alcatraz. She didn't know what we know. She didn't know what we know. And my mom was not a stupid woman. But so when I look back at my story and the various chaos I've created and the men I chose and the things that I was doing, I'm thinking, no wonder, you know, when I really feel love and important, it's because I was serving my father drinks, and that's what we had to do. So shortly after that time, my brother had his nervous breakdown. I was at a little friend's house. I was, I don't know, eighth grade at that point, seventh, eighth grade. And my mom called me, and she said, there's been a family emergency, and Diana needs to come home right away, and so off I go, and we go to my brother's house. He had just been married. He was only 18 or 19. They just had an infant, and he was catatonic. Like that. Like a statue. And everybody's running around the room. What do we do? What do we do? Hey, 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 you know. Hey, come on, you know, snap out of your catatonic nervous breakdown. That's the family I come from. Snap out of it. And so I remember mom going, he needs something to eat. Are you hungry? Are you hungry? Well, let's go get him something to eat. And I remember walking out the door, and I remember thinking, this isn't going to fix it. You know, like there was a part of me that had that logic. I was right. Like this wasn't going to fix it. At the same time, what I didn't realize was, you know, nothing was going to, I'm not in charge either. I am powerless. But I just went along with the family flow. Some years later, remember mom and dad saying, oh, God, he's married now. He'd married somebody else. Had another child. It was an infant. He was having another nervous breakdown. She had called and said, he is sitting in the window of our apartment with a shotgun. And he says he's going to shoot anybody that comes by. So what do? We all get in the car and go over there. Come on, you know, here we go, of course. And so I remember going up those stairs and, you know, trying to convince my brother to put the gun down. And one more time, you know, in Al-Anon, I get to look back and I get to ask, what were my parents thinking? Why were they exposing me to this, right? My part, of course, is I'm willing, and I do think I have the answers. I mean, that's the problem with me, is I'm your answer gal. You can drive by me on the freeway, and I'm like, she needs to cut her hair. You know, it's like, it's just right like that. Answers. And who wouldn't share the answers if she has them? What kind of person would withhold assistance from the world, the whole world, whether they're asking or not? And I remember telling that story about being called away from my best friend's house because my brother had a catatonic nervous breakdown and I'd been brought to the house. That was like 1972. My husband teases me, my frame of reference is 1972, and you know, I've recently kind of unpacked that and said, well, that's kind of when life as I knew it really ended. You know, the Bahia stuff was bad enough, but when he left the planet as we had known him, and I was sitting right there helpless, I don't think anything was ever, it wasn't ever the same again, and I certainly know for me it wasn't. And she said, well, if you were already at your best friend's house, why didn't your mom just ask to talk to her mom and say, we're having a family crisis, can you keep Diana? And I just burst into tears. I was like, could she have done that? I mean, my mom would have chewed off her right arm before she would have hurt me. But I'm telling you that right now. There, I only hope other people know the love that I knew from my mom. But she didn't know. She didn't know that we didn't have to gather and huddle the tribe in the face of insanity. She didn't know that we could protect the children, right? I know she wanted to, but I also know she couldn't. And, you know, I did exude a kind of a strength. It's okay, Mom, I've got this, right? It's okay, Mom, you know, I'm strong. And remember, I'm that second grader that's never going to tell her when I'm afraid. She is never going to know when I'm having a problem. My mother died never knowing my story. Except for she heard me lead an Al-Anon meeting right before she died. And I remember what she said to me after the meeting. I had no idea. Well, how would she? It was the last thing I was going to tell her. So I go on to college. I go at 15. I'm a little precocious, smarty pants kid, and carrying a big bag of shame and anxiety and fear and inadequacy and low self-worth with me. I don't know if I knew it. I certainly wouldn't have let you know it. So went off to school, went off to graduate school, and ended up at this top 10 PhD program where, believe me, the second grader did not belong. So I had to act like I thought graduate students acted, particularly those that were confident. So I was quite arrogant, quite mean. I would sit there at the coffee shop with another mean, arrogant friend of mine, and we would just attack everybody that went by. Just every inventory we could possibly take, we took. It really felt like power. I had no idea that I was feeding my own low self-esteem every time I put somebody else down. You know, if I can't accept your humanity, there is no way I'm going to be able to accept mine. But remember, I can't be human. I'm holding up this big family. I'm holding up a giant Lithuanian alcoholic father. I'm holding up this mother. I'm holding up a schizophrenic brother and the children that he's had. And, you know, it's a lot. I better be confident. I better know what I'm doing. And but I didn't, and I would not ask for help. So I got to the point in the PhD where you have to write a giant paper, basically, and I'm in second grade still. And so, you know, that's not going to happen, and I'm not going to tell anybody. So I start, you know, dancing and spinning plates, and by now I've taken a hostage, and we're married. And he says, you know, are you going to use the computer today? Because we share a computer, and we're both working on PhDs. And what I hear is, you know, you're just a stupid loser. So why don't you just get over the pretense? And that's what I would hear, and that's what I would respond to. Why are you asking me? What the hell do you want to know for? Well, I just wanted to know if they're going to use the computer today. You know, he's just this nice guy. And so at that time, Mom starts getting back pain. Can you come over and help me pack for my trip to Hawaii? I can't get the suitcase down. My back hurts. Now, remember, she's got a husband in the home, but he's alcoholic. And he loved her, but, you know, I'm there. I'm her husband. I'm my mom's husband. I go on cruises with her. She calls me from Sacramento. Oh, my God, I'm up here to visit the governor with this trip of the school district, and I've got this great room, and come on, you know. And it wasn't until Alan looked back, I was like, why was it me and not her husband? Of course, he wanted to stay home and drink, and she didn't want to be humiliated one more time on a plane or in a hotel room. Or, you know, she'd call me and say, oh my God, you know what he did this time, and they had to carry him off the plane. Or one time she was sobbing, and I said, what happened? She said, he made me go on a ski lift up at Big Bear during the summer, you know, you can see the sights, and she's was afraid of heights. And I didn't know till Alan, he didn't make her go. She could have said no. But she didn't have those words. You know, she was still trying to please that absent dad all those years later. And that's her story, and I'm not here to tell it. But I get to understand the context in which I was raised, because everything makes a whole lot of sense. So anyway, I go over there to help her with her back pain. Are you sure it's just back pain? Let's go to the doctor. Doctor says it's back pain. Are you sure it's just back pain? You know, she's 65. And yeah, you got arthritis. And he was dismissive, in my opinion. And I remember thinking, if this is cancer and he's blowing her off, I'm going to shoot him. So we can all laugh about that, and we can know how we talk big, but we can also know we're in a room full of Al-Anons. And I had a gun. Because by then... my brother had committed suicide. I was traveling in Europe in my early 20s doing a study abroad. And I would call Mom every day. We were so close. And she'd say, I'm just living for these phone calls. And I'd think, God, Mom, get a life. You know, you're such a whiner. Well, her son had killed himself. And she did not want to tell me. Because, you know, if you don't tell your daughter that her brother has killed himself, it hasn't happened, right? Like, I totally get it. Even in retrospect, I'm almost grateful. It would have ruined my summer, you know? It's true. But, of course, the bottom line is that was just how she knew how to deal with things, was try to protect me from pain, just like I was trying to protect her from pain. So I have his gun. He didn't shoot himself with the gun, but he had a gun, and my family gave it to me. My husband, the pacifist, didn't want it, and I didn't want it, but, of course, I didn't know you could say no until I got into program. So here we have this shotgun in the closet, and it turns out my mother has this extraordinarily rare cancer. And so now I have something else to fix. And I'm there in the hospital at Pomona Valley, and they're like, well, we think it's this certain cancer. And so I buzz out to the hallway, and I find the brochure, and I read it, and the doctor comes in. He goes, well, hey, I'm the weekend doctor. Is there anything she needs? And I said, she needs a blood transfusion. He's like, okay, nurse, blood transfusion. You know, 3 hours later, mom's sitting back up again, all pink and chirky, and you know what my Al-Anon ego has told me? Got this. I got this. And I start reading physicians' manuals and all about all the medications, and I start fighting with that dad of mine because he said the same thing he said about my brother's schizophrenia. That's not what it is. That's not what's happening. And we were coming home from radiation, and I said, you know, mom, with your kind of cancer, and my dad said, it's not cancer. Okay, you guys hadn't taught me yet that I didn't have to argue with an alcoholic when he says something stupid or crazy. So I argued with him. I said, of course it's cancer. And he said, no, it's a blood disorder. And I said, you know, she has an oncologist. Those are cancer doctors. We're coming home from radiation. You get radiation for tumor. And so finally I thought, you know what? This man won't listen to me, so I'm going to jump out of the moving vehicle. Right? So this is where, like, the AAs, at least they were drunk, right? I had nothing in, there was nothing in me. No substances in my body. And I opened that car door driving down San Bernardino Road. And, of course, I have a really powerful survival instinct. So I didn't actually jump. I'm just trying to get people's attention. The only suicide I ever affected was I faked. I mean, I took the pills, but not till my boyfriend actually took me to the ER. And I was like, oh, now I better eat these pills. Because I said, if he leaves me, I'll kill myself, you know. And it was supposed to make him just not leave me. But he was like, okay, see ya. And so I'm like gobbling down pills, going through the lobby of Pomona Valley. So that they won't pop my stomach and find out there's not pills in it, because remember what the most important thing is, is that I save face. So we pull up in the driveway after that fight, and one more time, and Dad and I are fighting one more time, and I'm like, oh, damn, this is exactly what you did with my brother. You denied, I didn't know that. I didn't know the disease of alcoholism. I didn't know that my dad was doing the best he could. I didn't know that this was how he had to see the world. I didn't know those things. I thought it was my responsibility to get him straight, and if I couldn't, I was unworthy. It is the simple math of this alcoholic child. Unless I can prove to my family that they can be fixed by my ministrations, I do not deserve joy. Well, I was wrong, I'm very happy to say. Mom called me sobbing from the hospital one more time, and she said, I'd asked, your father was so drunk on the phone, and I asked him not to come in and see me today, and he said, I'll do whatever the fuck I want. And I just heard this pop in my head. I swear I had some kind of like Al-Anon stroke. And I decided to kill him. So now I have a list of two people. Mom's doctor and my father. Now remember, I'm going to shoot my father because it's going to bring my mother peace. So, you know, when they say our best thinking gets us here, that is my best thinking. I had absolutely every intention of going through with it because I was out of ideas. You know, I had watered down the liquor. I had put a skull and crossbones on the bottle. I had brought home pictures of diseased livers. I asked him not to drink. That really didn't work. He literally drank more that time. So, anyway, my neighbor had said something about her friend, who something about her friend's husband, something about something called Al-Anon for families of alcoholics. And I was like, okay, look, I never ever ask anybody for help ever with anything, but I'm going to go ask these people if they can help me get him sober. And if they cannot, I am going to kill him. That was my truth. And I was driving to the Triangle Club in Pomona, and I'd driven by that little funky building ever since we moved there in 1965. I thought it was a private card club. I don't even know if there are private card clubs, but I heard somebody else say that recently. I was like, I thought that too. What does that mean? So no, it turned out it was a place where 12-step programs met, and I needed one. I didn't know that. If they had told me on the phone, oh good, you're finally ready to deal with the effects of someone else's alcoholism on you, I would have said, oh no. No, no. Something needs to change. It's not me. I don't need to change. I don't need... Are you kidding me? I am the only competent person in this family. Seriously. Like, I still kind of believe that. Because it's true. So, I walk in the door. I'm late. A beautiful angel is leading that meeting. I look around. I don't know what the deal is. I see the notebook. I think that's the teacher. I'm going to go up afterwards. I'm going to say, I've got a real hard case. Give me your strongest juju, whatever it is, the formula, whatever we have to do. And the leader starts to share, and she says, you know, I was driving over here looking at lawns, and I was thinking, if I was just in charge, your homes would look so fucking much better than they do. And I went, oh my God, I'm home. I mean, some people, it takes a while to get it. I got it. I'm a control freak. You know, what I heard was, I've been affected by my father's alcoholism. That's what I heard. And, you know, I saw that mumbo jumbo on the wall and God and this and that. And I thought, oh, God, you know, they're religious. Well, fine. You know, I'm, of course, the only higher power in my life. And the fact that I'm failing at it just means I need to try harder. Right. It doesn't mean I need to stop being my higher power. Oh, no. Oh, no, no. So I thought, that's okay. I'll just fake it. They want me to be religious. Something about this room, these people, they're breathing, they're laughing. Something's here, and I need what this is. I need it bad. I mean, I'm at a bottom. You're going to kill your dad. You're having an Al-Anon bottom. Seriously. And so I thought, I'll just fake it. And so I kept coming back. After the meeting, I said to a woman, my father's an alcoholic. You know, we're not allowed to tell anything in my family at all. Are you kidding? My brother's schizophrenic. Nobody can know that. My father's alcoholic. Nobody can know that. My brother kills himself. Nobody can know that. There's nobody can know anything. And she said, yes, it was mine. And she scribbled her number on a paper and handed it to me and walked away. And I remember thinking, hey, hello, fix me. Like, I've told you my problem. Aren't you going to rush to my aid? But another part of me was like, oh, my God, I'm not alone. Somebody else knows what this is like. I didn't know that. I didn't know that. I may have had little girlfriends that also came from chaotic homes, but we didn't share about what that meant. We didn't share about what that meant. And to realize that I had a tribe, you know? And afterwards, I shared. I came back the next week and shared, and the gal said, you want to come to lunch with us? I looked so horrified. She said, we're not asking you to marry us. And here I am thinking I'm confident and independent, and the last problem I have is relationships with other people. Like, I don't have any problems, right? You know, the problems are my alcoholic family. Mom's cancer, dad's, you know, alcoholism. Those are my problems. I'm not my problem. And so off to lunch I go, and, you know, it was nice to be asked to lunch when you had shared that you wanted to shoot your dad. And nobody told me I couldn't say that. Nobody told me I was overreacting, and nobody told me I shouldn't feel that way. And, you know, I've had a lot of most important moments in my life, but that was one of the most important moments in my life, because what they were basically telling me, transmitting to me, you guys were telling me, was it's okay for me to be me. However, I had to stop acting like me. I also understood that after a while. I did not know my father's drinking did not justify my behavior. I just did not know that. I absolutely thought what you did exonerated me from any reaction whatsoever that I was having. And I went home from that first meeting and I said to my husband, I'm the child of an alcoholic and I have baggage and I've been treating you badly and taking it out on you, and I'm going to do every single thing I can from this moment on to change. And I've kept that promise. It's been 20 years. And I took those tools you gave me and I ran with them. You know, I remember the first time I went over to Dad's and he started some stupid alcoholic fight with me. And I said, well, maybe you're right, Dad, because you guys had told me to say that. And I was like, he's not right. And they said, well, you're not saying he's right. You're saying maybe he's right. And so, you know what he said? You know what he said? Don't ever tell me I'm right. And I was free. I was free. I was like, oh my God, it's not about me. It's not that he looks at his little girl as unworthy. It's nothing to do with me at all. Alcoholics want to fight, and I've been volunteering and then calling him argumentative. And planning to kill him because of it. They told me they said his drinking's none of your business. I said, that's what he tells me. I didn't come here to hear what the alcoholic tells me. So I remember one time my father came out after Christmas morning. He said, can you tell me who gave me my gifts? Because I can't remember. And I said, and you don't think your life's unmanageable, and you don't think you have a problem with alcohol, and you're in a blackout, and you don't know who gave you your Christmas presents? And the phone rang, and I said, I'm going to go answer that phone, and I'm never going to mention your drinking to you again. And I didn't.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
I just decided to love my daddy. You guys gave me my daddy back, and I loved him, and he loved me. And I remember one time he said to me, oh, I drank too much yesterday. I said, oh, Daddy, that's none of my business. Well, I just love you. I just love you. And I finished that PhD because you guys, you know, you told me to turn on the computer. And I was like, that's not going to help. You know, I have to write a whole book. I don't understand. And they said, you know, get a book out of the library and then say good job. And that's all you have to do. I didn't know I could be easy with myself and eat that elephant one step at a time. I mean, really was out of control. My last sponsor said, you're overdeveloped intellectually. You're underdeveloped spiritually, emotionally, mentally, you know? And boy, was she right. Boy, was she right. So I get the PhD. I get a job in Texas. I have a higher power by now. It's mine. I'm a very religious woman. I'm the only member of my congregation. You guys gave me this gift, and I'll thank you for it for the rest of my life. Everyone will thank you for it. It is better that I have a higher power. But my higher power took me to Texas. It was all green lights. I did everything I could not to go. My mother was dying. They gave me an offer. I told her about it, and she was supposed to say, don't go, and I wouldn't have gone. And she said, well, I have advantage miles, and I can come visit you. And, I mean, we were in a restaurant. I had to go to the bathroom and retch, and that's when I realized, oh, I thought she needed me, but I need her to need me so that I don't have to be me and grow up. And she handed me that gift, and I told my higher power, you better let me know when she needs me. Because, you know, my father was there for her in his alcoholic way. And when she ended up, after the first year I was teaching in Texas, I flew home, and within days she said to me, I'm dying. And my father said, you are not. And I said, you know, if you can't have this conversation, leave us. And he left the room. Because he couldn't, and I could. And Mom told me where she wanted to be buried. And you know, later that day, we ended up calling the paramedics, and off we went on that journey. My mom died. You know, people die. People die. And that wasn't something that I was willing to accept. I thought I had to make the world spin the other way. But when she was checked into the hospital that night, they came for the intake thing or outtake or whatever. You're not going to go home after you're comatose. But they said, what's the family situation like? And I said, my father's an alcoholic. And they wrote that down on the paper. And I was kind of filled with like, oh, my God, I told, you know. But I thought, well, if they're going to send her home, they need to know. She lives at home with a practicing alcoholic. My dad had retired at that point, 1.75 milliliter vodkas every, you know, bottles a day. So now I'm in Texas. So her oncologist comes and gets me and attacks me and says, you said your father is an alcoholic. You're wrong. You don't know. She said, he carries her into the appointments in his arms. And, you know, I felt that shame, and I knew what to do, because I have you now as a tribe. You're my family as well. And I ran and I made a call, and a woman picked up the phone, and I said, the oncologist just said, I don't know what I'm talking about, and I came in from wherever. And she said, you know the truth. She doesn't know you. This is alcoholism. And, you know, she just told me what you guys tell me, which is it's okay for us to tell the truth. It's okay for me to be from an alcoholic family. And I remember a few days later, my dad came reeling in, just shit-faced, into the intensive care unit where Mom was on a ventilator. And I felt that shame, and I thought, no, I told him. And he has to get drunk to come and visit his comatose wife, and that's pretty sad. And I don't have to be the monster anymore that gets in his way and gets in his face. I don't know his story. He did love my mother. She died holding his hand. Okay, so off I go to Texas. I ended up getting an opportunity to come back to California, which I took. My husband got a job, and we moved back, and I found my father dying of congestive heart failure. This was in 2000. I took him to the doctor. They said, take him to the ER. They drained 25 pounds of fluid out of him, and they put him on Lasix, and I became his primary caregiver. with utter love and joy and respect and dignity that he deserved as my daddy. And I told that first Al-Anon sponsor of mine when I realized who I was and what I'd been doing. I said, how could I ever make amends to this man for what I've done to him? And she said, oh, you don't have to say a word. Just from now on, just treat him with respect. And so for that last 11 years of his life, I got to treat him with respect, and I actually got to take care of him. Now, I'd go over to his house, and as my husband put it at one point, he was like, if it weren't 8 o'clock in the morning, I'd think your father was drunk. It's like, well, yeah. You know, because he was a hoarder and an alcoholic, and he'd be sitting there with his big red cup, surrounded by stacks of newspapers, piss-stained, you know, in his dirty clothes. And, you know, I got to go up and just give him a big hug every time and say, I love you, Daddy. And then we'd throw away the garbage that we could, and I'd order him Meals on Wheels, and I'd write the checks and pay the bills and bring in a week's worth of shopping. And I remember one time I was sharing my story that I said, Dad, you've wet yourself. Let's go to the shower. Nope. You know, okay, you get a 6'4" alcoholic Lithuanian into the shower that doesn't want to go. So I was like, all right. So I went and got the blow dryer, and I was blow drying his pants. And what's so cool is this young woman that I now sponsor, she said to me, I was new and I heard that story, and I thought, somebody else knows what it's like. She gets it. She gets it. And, you know, that's the magic of the experience, strength, and hope here. I just needed to find out I wasn't the only person with my story. In recovery, I have gotten an opportunity to recover. At my 14th Al-Anon birthday, a whole bunch of us went over to a mud shack and I made my own ashtray. Because I'm real. I'm not an imposter. None of us is. There is no such thing. But now what sits on my chest is my ashtray that I made in my recovery. When I got back from Texas in 2000, I thought, oh, I'll have my old sponsor. She was so perfect for me. And she happened to be at the first meeting I went to, which wasn't one where I usually would see her. And she shared, and she said, I have so many sponsees, and my family's mutinying, and they're so furious with me, and I'm not going to be able to sponsor people, and I'm going to have to cut the... And I just was like, oh, my God, this is the worst thing ever. Why me? She's got to sponsor me. I'm home. Doesn't she know? And I thought, well, what will you do if you have to change, right? I'm not great at change, right? I'm great at burrowing through the rock. And so I thought, well, there was that woman I called that time from Pomona Valley. I just kind of liked her vibe. I called her and I said, will you be my sponsor? And she said, well, I'm busy. And I said, you know, I don't really have much going on. Things are pretty good. And I said, the only thing is I haven't written a book. And she said, well, why do you need to write a book? And I was like, I don't need to write a book. Was such a weight off my chest. I can't tell you. Because I was just crushed one more time by who I was supposed to be and then the reality of my own existence. And so, you know, in the morning on my knees, I started surrendering that book. I surrender everything in the morning on my knees to my higher power that I am powerless over. I ended up, you know, getting to be there for my father who breathes his last breaths, begging me for booze. Booze, 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 booze. 82 years old. And I got to give it to him or not give it to him or whatever. I mean, you guys gave me choices I just didn't know I had. I remember the first time when I was doing his grocery years before that, and he asked me for the big bottle. And I said, I just can't, Dad. I just can't. I can't stand to see what it does to you. And he said, well, alcohol's good for you. They say a drink's good for somebody, you know. It's like, yeah, well, you're going to have to get it on your own. But I think by the end of his life, I didn't even care. So I had a beautiful relationship with my dad when he died. And that was 2007. Since 2000, I was sponsored by a beautiful woman. Her name was Di. And a couple of years ago, she got a rare cancer, advanced when they diagnosed it. And same age as my mom. And I started to realize that she had come into my life when my mother was dying and had not only been my beautiful, wise Al-Anon sponsor, but had also loved me like my mom had loved me. And so it's just not possible for her to die, too. See, I'm right back where I started. She can't die. She can't die. And, you know, you got somebody with stage 4 cancer, and then you got me again being, you know, like, this isn't going to happen. I got anxious, so anxious, because hers was in remission for a year, just like mom's, and I knew what was going to happen, and sure enough, it came roaring back, and I'd known that was going to happen, and I just feel totally alone, and you're knocking on my office door at work, and I'm jumping out of my chair, and I just thought, oh my God, something's wrong with me, you know, my recovery's not enough, and I heard a voice, seek outside help. I was all, huh? Okay. I've never done that, right? I'm not the type to go to therapy because you'd have to tell somebody else something was wrong with you, and that had never appealed to me. I like our room because we're all the same. So I call my insurance. I'm led to the perfect person. I tell her my story. she just, her jaw dropped. She goes, how did you find me? Like, I'm the perfect person. I was like, well, I didn't find you because I'm not running my life anymore, thank goodness. And so she said, you're trying to go through this without changing. And that's why you're anxious. Huge weight off. That's all I needed to hear. That, and you know where this is going. I said, I do. I said, I do. She said, yeah, she's going to die. I was like, God, thank you for admitting it. I just needed people to be able to tell the truth. You know, I grew up in a family where the truth was not true. People aren't sick. People aren't depressed. People aren't alcoholic. People aren't dying, you know, and there's, and they are. They just are. That's not the whole panoply of life, but that's life. And this same sponsor had told me now for going on 14 years, life is like the tides. We come together in joy and we part in sadness. And it's just the natural rhythm of existence. And, you know, she's parting. And when that therapist said, you need to change, then she said, I don't know how you're going to change. And I said, oh, I don't either. But change I can do, because you changed me when you told me to butt out of his alcoholism. You taught me how to change when you told me to butt out of her marriage. Wasn't it my choice that she married an alcoholic? That was her choice. And she got to make choices. And he got to make choices. And you guys gave me the right to make my choices and to be well. And so I went back down to the Bahia Hotel. God took me there because at work I'm of maximum service to my young students. And there was a conference. I said, I'll teach you how to give a conference paper and write a conference and be a professional, you know, in our profession. And so here it was at the Bahia, and I just knew God was saying it's time. So off she and I went. We drove down there, and I told her the story on the way. I said, you know, my dad smashed his head open here in 1967, and I know I'm being led back. And, you know, after I said that, I thought, should I tell her that? And then I was like, who cares? Like, I really got nothing to hide at this point in my life. Yeah, I'm spiritual. Uh-oh. You know. Well, I'm, you know, there goes my cool card, as the speaker said last night. So we pull up in front of the hotel, and I'm like, oh, there's a pool. I've forgotten all about it. And then I'm like, it's the pool. I walk in. I see it. And, you know, to my dad, in my dad's defense, it was a very deep end that then abruptly went straight up to shallow. And they actually had a high dive in the 60s there. So, I mean, he was hammered, you know. He was drunk on vodka. My brother recently said, oh, yeah, that was that day Dad had been drinking vodka all day. But I thought, yeah, well, no wonder he cracked his skull open. So anyway, I was a professional, lovely, dignified, gracious to my student, let her take the podium and give our talk. Other people were like, oh, my God, people would never give away that podium. I was, it hadn't even occurred to me not to let this kid do it. I'm mentoring her. But that's how you have taught me, that I can be that person. I don't have to always be in the front, you know. Hey, look at me. So, but then I started to feel sick the next day, and I knew the grief was coming, and I just told her I need some alone time. And I went back to my room, and I cried and prayed and made phone calls and read. And then I wrote my mom a letter on Bahia Stationery. And I said, you know, Mom, I needed you to be a grown-up that day, and you weren't. And you weren't. And I also got to tell her, I forgive you. And then I said, but it's different today. No more screaming. No more turmoil. No more public scenes. No more chaos. My life's not like that. You know, life's an exciting enough journey without adding the drama. I am drama averse. I am drama averse at this point. And last year in June, 2 days before my mother's death anniversary, my beloved sponsor died. And, you know, after that, I had to set some boundaries with some people that had been in my life and were just not well, good for me. And I got to let them go, and that was part of the change. I thought I had to be everybody's everything all the time and love you well, and man, I fall into that trap fast. Well, I'll just act calm and normal, and eventually this person will too. It doesn't work that way. Don't bother. Don't bother. And so, you know, by the time she was dead, I had a new sponsor, and I didn't want to get one. I don't like change. I don't want to tell another woman that I need help, especially not a stranger. But I know for me today, there's really not an alternative. And so I called Joy. God shoved Joy up my ass because I went to a meeting, and I said, I need help. And she passed me her card. And so the next day, I was lecturing a sponsee about, you know, doing the right thing. And then I little voice is like, how about you, Diana? Are you going to get that new sponsor? You know? And so I called her, and I said, I'm afraid you're going to ask me to do something, you know. so I don't want to call you. She said, I'm not going to ask you to do anything. You're going through a lot. You know, just be gentle with yourself. And sure enough, she's been there for me every single time I've needed somebody to call as I walked through the death of my beautiful sponsor. And I am so grateful for that. I was going to wait a few years, you know, send out questionnaires, interview people, you know, do some kind of Excel spreadsheet cross-referencing my characteristics with yours. And, you know, instead of that, I just took the hand that was stuck out. And I love her. She's been in program 40 years. And, you know, I'll call her. I called her the other day from the AT&T store. And I said, I have a brand new iPhone 6S, but I actually have a functional 5S. And I don't know what to do, you know. And she said, well, I don't have an opinion about your phone. But I love that. I'm like, oh, man, thanks for handing me the responsibility, you know, for my own life, because I really have thought I wanted that my whole life, but really I made you responsible for it. I made you responsible for my emotional well-being. I held you responsible if I wasn't achieving like I was supposed to be achieving. And, you know, I knew God took me back to the Bahia so that I could recover that piece of myself. And I actually went after I wrote the letter and I retraced the steps. I was like, where did Mom drag me that day? Because here's the hotel and here's this other part of the hotel and here's the pool. So I just recreated the steps, and it turned out there was an old wing that's not open anymore, and it's behind all this stuff, and it was like this kind of horror show. It was like uncovering my unconscious, and I was like, that's where our room was. And it was just healing. I'm just being healed. I am being healed. I'm not healing myself. I'm not figuring stuff out. I just keep showing up. And finally, you know what it's like today. It's pretty great. You know, my life's pretty great. I ran into my high school teacher from all those years ago. She's retired in Texas, and she invited me back for a visit this year, and I got to go because you guys taught me. I get to show up for my life. I can say yes to stuff. And all the way there, I'm kind of like, why am I going? And I even said to her, why do you want to be friends with me? You know, and she said, well, birds of a feather, which I don't know. I didn't ask what that means. But we had an important and interesting and fabulous visit, and I got to, one more time, just pick up pieces of myself and pieces of my story as I'm recovering. But on the plane on the way home, I was sitting next to this blonde woman, and I didn't want to talk to anybody, you know. That's me. Leave me alone. And 20 years of recovery later, I still want to isolate. So we start to talk, and immediately the conversation gets really deep, really fast, and it's about her relationship, and she's with this man, and blah, 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 and doesn't think she wants to be, but she's with him, and she's kind of stuck. And so I brought up my father's alcoholism and what it taught me, and it turns out her father's an alcoholic too. And a few minutes into our conversation, I said, yeah, and my mom has died already of a rare cancer, and she said, so did mine, and we locked eyes, and I knew. And she knew. And indeed, our mothers had died of the same extremely rare cancer. And here come the chills. And we started to talk, and she started to tell her story, and I started to tell my story, and it was the same story. You know, it was the strong, loving, confident daughter of an alcoholic father and an unrecovered Al-Anon mom who got back pain. And she was trying to fix it, and she was trying to get the dad involved, and she was trying to get the mom to care more about herself than she cared about her mom. And I said to her, this wasn't even my seat this morning on the plane. You know, I just got something that said click here and you can move up. And I did. And she said, same with me. She said, this wasn't my seat. This wasn't my seat either. And I can't tell you, except it's my job to tell you this morning, what that did to me, to find out I wasn't alone. I just needed to hear somebody else, another daughter, had the same story. I just needed to know it, and I didn't know I needed to know it. But my higher power knew I needed to know it. And, you know, we got off that plane, and I walked in the house, and I looked at my husband, and I said, I don't know if you can tell, but I'm changed. I'm changed. And it was a whole series of things, not just that conversation, but that was such a crucial piece. I just was in awe. I know we all have our same, I'm used to sharing and experience strength and hope, but I didn't know another daughter had walked through that with her mom. And we're in touch to this day. It's beautiful. And that same day I said to my husband, let's take a trip. I just feel so free. Let's go somewhere. And I meant like Boston. And within a few hours, we decided to go to Hanoi. Because you have set me free. Because of you, I am free. I am free to walk about the planet calmly, with dignity, in safety, anywhere. So we went to Cambodia and we went to Vietnam. But I bought the tickets within a few hours. And then I was like, I wonder if you need a visa to go to Vietnam. I don't know. So my friends call, and I'm like, well, yeah, but we can't meet Sunday because I'll be in Vietnam. They're like, you're what? I know, what? Like, oh, I got a passport. Let's go. Let's go. And so it turns out you need a visa and this, that, and the other. One option, the best option, as far as I was concerned, was to drive to San Francisco and pick up the visa from Southern California. And so I did, joyously, hopped in my car and headed up the 5. There isn't anything that I do today that I don't see through the lens of my spiritual walk. That's all there is to it. Like, there is no sacred over here and secular over here. Because I chose to give my will and my life to Al-Anon in May of 1995, and I have never not done that. I'm not saying I did it perfect, you understand, but I have never not looked at life through the prism of this recovery program ever since then. Everything I do is filled with meaning. Everything I do. And so as I drove to San Francisco, I knew there were reasons that I was being led there, not just I like to drive and the joy of picking up a visa and not having to wait in a long immigration line in Hanoi after a 16-hour flight, you know. I also knew that things were going to be happening there, and I didn't know what. And, you know, at one point while I was driving through the city free, I drove past my parents' favorite restaurant that they had always talked about and fetishized, and I don't know if they got to go to on that trip or not, but as I drove by, I just got to feel those pieces coming back together of their daughter being free of the insanity of alcoholism. It is so hard for me today to even think about the harms that my parents caused me, because I am so filled with gratitude for what they did for me and for who they were and for their valiant fight against untreated alcoholism, that I'm just in awe. And, you know, every morning on my knees, I surrender my will to my higher power. You know, I ask for 24 hours of character defects being lifted to help, if I could be of service to anybody and to me and to my higher power. And then I see my mom and my dad and my brother and my sponsor. And you know, I just hug them all and I just thank them all. I ask for peace for them and their children's children, and peace for the whole planet, and I ask to be an instrument of that peace. And I pray the prayer that I made up 20 years ago when you guys taught me to pray, and I always end it with, help me walk through today in serenity with a light heart, because I deserve to be here and you love me. That's all there is. It's that simple. But, you know, for us Al-Anons, we can really complicate things. And I tell you, I'm changed, and I think that's my theme today. You know, I have changed. I am willing to continue to change. I'm going through the change. I want to go through it without changing. And I've become a little obsessed with that this week. It's like, how about if I don't change? And it's like, well, you're changing. How about if you change? How about more surrender, more acceptance, a deeper walk, more trust? And the nice thing is that my higher power hasn't ever let me down. I have never regretted letting go of the Diana version of reality and getting in sync with reality, because I actually find it quite majestic. I find much joy in this planet. I find much joy in other people. I find much joy in myself. I'm a source of acceptance and love. I hear what comes out of my mouth sometimes, and I just think, oh my God, what? Why are you so nice? I only hope I can be a half of the source of kindness and acceptance and love and wisdom that my sponsor was, and I'm proud to carry her message forward today, because she always taught me to identify with people. You know, I'm a judger, I'm a fixer, I'm a comparer, and she said, I want you to identify, and I'd call back and I'd say, hey, I didn't rip her a new one, you know, I was able to, and she'd always say, this is healing you, and I just didn't understand that. I could see why it was great that I wasn't out there hacking people, you know, with machetes, and I thought that was some kind of an accomplishment. I didn't realize that in not hacking you with a machete, I was actually taking the machete off of myself and not having to hack myself with a machete anymore, and that's just deepening. I'm not I'm not perfect, you know, I still see solutions sometimes and act on them. The other day, I had another package stolen off my front porch. My Amazon packages are getting filched, and I'm not happy about it. So I got home from work and I just walked straight to the backyard of the recycles. I got an empty Amazon box. I walked around my yard. I filled it with dog shit. Not even thinking twice. I sealed it back up beautifully, put a label on it, put it out on the front porch. I put a note on the door to remind myself, you put a box of dog shit on the front porch, because I could just see getting home from work later that day going, oh, what? For me? hoisted by my own petard, that's called. So anyway, off I go, off to work. And I had a little fleeting, maybe you should ask your sponsor. I'm not even so sure what this new gal would say, because, you know, she's kind of hands-off. Like, she told me I don't have to sponsor people I don't like. I was like, what? I thought I had to love everybody and do everything for everybody all the time, and then I realized again how I can take these beautiful tools and just manipulate them into toxicity. I lack a balance meter in my head, and so, you know, it's not good for you if I don't want to be around you either. I didn't realize that, you know, when I ended some relationships. I'm thinking I'm doing me a favor. I'm doing them a favor. The last thing you need to do is be friends with somebody who's constantly thinking, for the love of God, would you just be somebody else? You know, this is not really great. So anyway, I'm coming home from work, and I get a call from my husband. My husband says, oh, my neighbor says that we got a package from Amazon. And so since we've been having those thefts, she picked it up for us. And I said, that's a box full of dog shit that I put out there to catch the criminal and, I guess, just basically send a general, you know, up yours to or whatever. We're on to you. And, of course, we're on to him. He's taking the packages. Like, we wouldn't know our packages aren't there. But anyway, so I hung up that phone and I started to call her to shame her. I started to call her and go, you know, that was a box of dog shit that I put out to catch criminals, but actually I caught a nosy, controlling neighbor. And you guys have taught me to check my motives. It's that simple. And I asked myself, why would you make that call? And I thought, because I want to shame her. And so I don't have to be her today. So I called my husband back. I said, all right, look, I'm not going to say anything to her. And so he went over after he got off from work, a much nicer person than I am. And he picked up the box. He said, thank you so much. He said, we get so much shit from Al-Anon, from Amazon. So much shit from Amazon. And they laughed, and he didn't have to tell her that there was a box of shit. And I mean, I guess if there's a metaphor for my program today, you know what I mean? I just don't have to turn gifts into boxes of shit. And then he put it out in the alley. He said, I don't want to irritate a criminal, and that's probably a fine idea too. So anyway, you know, I just want to end with thanking all of you for my life. I want to end with thanking you for the lives of the people that I touch. For some reason that I will never understand, I was able to hear you, and I can still hear you. And it is a message that I want to hear, and I don't have to carry it to people who don't want to hear it. I don't have to fix people. I do not owe the world an explanation. Right. I can remember the first time I heard all of these things that you guys told me, and I actually can stop, smell the flowers, enjoy life, and, you know, easy does do it. I've gotten a lot accomplished. I can write again. Yeah, I've published a lot. I'm working on that book. I get to work on it the rest of my life if I want. I just got a high promotion at my job. People are being real nice to me now because they want what, you know, they want what I have, and I have to be careful because that power, that sniff. I'm smelling power, and I'm like, ooh, I could really hurt that woman I've never cared for, you know. But then, you know, my recovery comes in, and it's like, yeah, that's your human, that's your ego, let's be better than that. But I don't have to be better than human. I don't have to be better than human. I have to act better than I feel. And, you know, somebody with as much discipline and control as I have, if I'm putting that into my recovery, it can come out pretty well. So I'm grateful today for the external stuff, but really to me it's just a manifestation of what you did, which is you put my hand in my God's hand, and you've left it there. And then I get to carry that on to others and just let them know. There's a lifeboat for families of alcoholism, and Al-Anon is it. So thank you for listening.
This recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.